Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with Pink Floyd and Money to introduce our show on taxes and war tax resistance. The deadline for filing tax returns is coming up fast. We get a few extra days this year, with the deadline falling at midnight on April 18th. But there's a group of people who are not harassed by this deadline, this year or any other year. They are war tax resistors, the people who protest war by refusing to pay all or any portion of the taxes the Internal Revenue Service says they owe.
War tax resistance is definitely a part of many different cultures and movements. The common theme is people whose conscience calls them to dissociate themselves from directly contributing to war.
Susan Quinlan has resisted paying for war for more than 25 years. She's modified elements of her life to do this, yet, as we'll hear from her, she has a rich and interesting life. We'll hear about her efforts and some of the methods that she and people like her use to protest war, as well as why they protest war. We'll also hear from Elizabeth Borden, another war tax resistor who uses different methods to resist, and what happened to her when the IRS came calling.
I think the season leading up to tax day is very frustrating for a lot of Americans because of all the paperwork and the knowledge that, you know, the rich are benefiting in ways that the rest of us aren't and the tax system is unjust. But for those of us who believe that war is an atrocity and a crime against humanity, it's particularly frustrating. So that's where war tax resistance offers some relief, in that there are actually very many options for people who would like to withdraw their support from war. Those of us who are out, you know, writing letters, sending emails, marching, organizing against U.S. militarism, we actually have a chance to put our money where our hearts are and redirect our funds away from the absolutely unbelievably large military budget that is being accumulated in this country.
Essentially, tax resistors take steps to ensure that few of their earned dollars go toward upholding a system that funnels vast amounts of money into war and militarism and away from people and places at home. Susan's refusal to pay the state and federal government does not mean that she keeps that money for herself and her family.
My idea from the very beginning was that I would refuse to pay 100% of my taxes. Many people will pay, the portion that's not military and then resist the portion that is. But my feeling was that they're going to take half of whatever I give them, so I'd rather redirect the entire amount. So from the very beginning, I have donated, exactly as much as I would have owed to groups that are doing the kinds of positive things that I think we should be supporting. So I began to do that back in about 1982, which ironically I was working for the federal government at the time. I was in the Peace Corps. And pretty much ever since I have done that. It's been about 25 years.
Most people take it for granted that they must pay taxes. They may not even realize that there are other options. Even so, war tax resistance takes deep commitment and a willingness to adjust to sacrifices that others may not understand. Why do it?
I just decided that I wasn't going to work at cross purposes with my ethical commitments. So what that meant was that if they came after my salary, that I would leave a job. And I've only had to do that once. But I did do that, and it was fine. I left a job and went and found another one. It's also meant that I've chosen to make the decision not to own anything, which means that I live in community with other people and I trust my friends and family instead of making myself vulnerable to the government. So, you know, it's got its pros and cons. I am, in a sense, vulnerable to my community, but that feels much better to me than making myself vulnerable to the government. So the long and the short of it is that I have a very comfortable, wonderful life. But, you know, to some people it might look a little scary, you know, not to have certain assets in my name.
As we will hear throughout the show, there are many different methods of tax resistance. Some people choose to directly confront the IRS as a form of civil disobedience, while others choose a more under-the-radar method and simply keep their heads down and refuse to be counted. There are networks for tax resistors, and these include the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee as well as the Northern California War Tax Resistance Group, but none of these groups keep track of how many war tax resistors there are. Nevertheless, I asked Susan for her best guesstimate on how many tax resistors she thought there might be across the country.
It's very difficult to ever count us because we aren't always cooperative with that sort of effort. You know, it's probably safe to say 10,000. It may be many, many more than that who are, you know, consciously resisting war taxes and willing to do it publicly. Of course, the number of people who are trying to stay out of the tax system for these same reasons is probably much higher.
If they agree in principle to protest war by not paying, do war tax resistors follow the same methods of resistance?
There are lots of different methods. You know, almost everybody will take, you know, whatever methods appear available to them to lower their tax liability. That's why people go to tax professionals, is to try to figure out how to pay less taxes. The difference here is that war tax resistors will often take an act of civil disobedience and say, okay, here's what you say I owe, and I'm not going to pay all or part of that. But there are also other ways of doing it that are legal that are not acts of civil disobedience, but simply methods for using the tax laws that are available in order not to contribute to war.
Susan referred to ways of not paying taxes that are legal that are not acts of civil disobedience. One way that has come to light in the last weeks and that has angered many individuals, whether they are war protesters or not, is learning that General Electric used all the loopholes available through tax laws and paid not a penny of tax in 2010 on its $14.2 billion profit. The bulk of those profits, some $9 billion, went offshore. On top of paying nothing in taxes, GE got a $3.2 billion tax benefit. Despite GE's status under the law as a legal person, there are few actual people who come close to being able to use these same loopholes to the same effect. Nevertheless, there are methods that ordinary people can use that are legal and require no confrontation with the IRS if that is what someone wants to do. Susan details some of these.
People choose their method according to, you know, a lot of other life considerations. And that may change over time. So, you know, I took a kind of an extreme approach in that I decided that I did not want to pretty much ever let the government get my money. And that's just based on seeing that the militarism that we see right now has been an ongoing situation pretty much back into the history of this country. It's built on using force and violence to expropriate resources from other people. I didn't want to be a part of that. So I made the decision to completely eliminate withholding at my jobs. And that means using the W-4 form to take extra allowances or declare oneself exempt when you start a job. So I've done that all along. If somebody's already in a job, they can always redo their W-4 and add extra allowances. And to the degree that this, you know, takes you out of being taxed when the government thinks you should be, that is an act of civil disobedience. So it's not something that should be done without a, you know, some research and thought. But that's what many people do, is eliminate the withholding at the employment and then choose how much, if any, to pay at the end of the year. So some people will then withhold a symbolic amount and pay all but, you know, perhaps $100, just to make the point that you are stealing this money from me, but I know you're going to get it eventually because I'm not going to leave my job and I'm not going to, you know, I'm going to have a home and a bank account and all those things. And, you know, the government will go through a certain procedure and eventually will collect that money. They'll probably spend a lot more money collecting it than what they collected. And for the resistor, it means that they may end up paying up to about 20% of whatever they resisted in penalties and interest. And then other people will just simply set up their lives in such a way that the government cannot collect the money. And eventually the government will usually just give up on those people. And then a third method is to use the tax system that's set up and, you know, by playing the games that wealthy corporations have been playing all along. Of course, we don't have all the same access to those ins and outs as individuals, but some people are able to reduce their tax liability through legal means so that they are not doing civil disobedience. They're simply reorganizing their lives.
For many of us, myself included, the idea of confronting the IRS, never mind actually facing them down, is daunting. There is something so scary about the IRS's ways that seems so mysterious. I certainly count myself as one of these intimidated people. What is interesting, though, is that I have had to confront the IRS in the past, and it turned out to my advantage. But still, I don't want to have to do it again. It's very time-consuming, and then I still question what would happen if the IRS really came after me. What happens when the IRS comes after someone and threatens to take away property when she's worked so hard to earn the money to be able to make that purchase?
It's pretty unlikely that you would lose your property, but what is likely is that there might be a lien placed on a property so that at the point that you sold it, say you owed, you know, $300, they would collect that money out of the sale of your home. If you had been resisting, you know, thousands of dollars each year over 20 or 30 years, people usually have to think about those things when they're deciding in what way they're going to resist. And of course, there are lots of creative ways people have used land trusts or, you know, different mechanisms to give themselves security, you know, in terms of where they live or that sort of thing, and keep themselves relatively free of collection. There are a lot of people who aren't war tax resisters who use these methods for other reasons. And so, you know, just to be aware that sometimes they have been persecuted by the government, and sometimes we have found within the war tax resistance movement that people might be given a little more assurance than the reality ends up playing out. But on the other hand, there are people who seem to be very happy with it. And then just the only other thing I would mention is that there are some people who, rather than withdrawing from the tax system, would like to confront the government around militarism. So some people choose to use war tax resistance as a way to engage with the government and to do civil disobedience for a purpose, while other people, both within war tax resistance and within the other tax resistance movements, would like to withdraw. You know, there's a method for everyone. If you want to get in there and you know, really take a stand, you can do that through a confrontational method, or there are other ways, either, you know, legally or sort of slipping under the table, that you might be able to simply pull yourself out of the tax system. The word empowerment comes to mind. It can be extremely disempowering to get up every morning and, you know, read the newspaper and see all these terrible things that are being done with the fruits of our labor. So, you know, the more than a paycheck is this ripple effect of, you know, we're out there trying to survive, and then, you know, resources are being taken away from us to do harm both to us and to people around the world. So when you can take a stand against that, it feels really good.
These days, many Americans have the impression that most of our tax dollars go towards social programs, including generous contributions to struggling people in other countries. Actual numbers are notoriously difficult to tease out of the federal budget that the public sees. But what is the ballpark percentages of each tax dollar that goes to war and militarism?
Consistently over the last 25 years, military spending has eaten up approximately half of our federal discretionary budget. And what that means is that for every dollar that we pay in taxes, 50% of it goes for war, and 50% is split between all the other things that most of us would much rather see.
Of this 50% going to war, does that mean 50% when we're on a wartime footing, as we are now, or to keep the military and its associated organizations up and running?
It's remained just as high. In fact, at one point it went up to about 64%, and I'm not even sure we were in a war at that time. So it's really, you know, the militarism that, you know, is such a huge part of this economy demands excessive resources from us, whether there's actually a war going on or not. And part of that is that every time we wage war, we're doing it on borrowed money. So we're not only paying for, you know, for the weapons and the damages that are being done, but we're also paying interest on the past military spending. So it just keeps escalating, and the burden is falling on the next generation, which is really unfair, because at the same time that we're robbing them by directing resources away from their education and the protection of their environment, we're also burdening them with debts based on the military spending that we're racking up right now.
So what kind of numbers are we actually talking about? Well, more than $1 trillion spent on war since 2001, but that number is difficult to grasp, so let's break it down. Close to $784 billion spent for the war in Iraq, and $400 billion spent in Afghanistan. Another way to look at it is the state of California has spent $148 billion on war, while the state of Louisiana has spent almost $9 billion. And I chose to talk about the state of Louisiana because you know it continues to struggle long after Hurricane Katrina and now the Deepwater oil rig disaster that happened a year ago. These things are a tremendous burden on Louisiana, but they're still paying for the war. And then to take a smaller state, let's go with Vermont. It's contributed $1.5 billion to the war since 2001. And let's take a moment and contrast this with, as mentioned earlier, a corporation like GE that paid no taxes at all for 2010. Not only did GE not pay taxes, but neither did they help in getting struggling Americans back on their feet. GE employs more than half its workforce outside the United States, but it also closed 20 U.S. factories between 2007 and 2009, and it laid off 21,000 American workers. And to add insult to injury, President Obama takes advice on job creation from GE's CEO Emmelt. Nevertheless, an overriding problem with all the numbers the public is privileged to see is that very few of them take into account that the aftermath of war continues well into the future and that these numbers are not presented in the annual budget. The National War Tax Resisters Coordinating Committee shows 18 cents of every current dollar pays for wars that occurred before 2001, that is over and above the 30 cents of each dollar paying for the war since 2001. Another way to bring this home is to consider the price of one 5.56 millimeter caliber lead bullet. In 2002, it cost 21 cents to purchase that simple bullet. But the cost of cleaning up a military shooting range where they train troops to shoot that bullet brings the cost of that little one-leaded bullet to 98 cents. And that's not counting the cost of storing and distributing that bullet to combat troops.
We look at what's being done to the veterans of the current conflict. It doesn't end when they come home. It doesn't end when they leave service. They're many of them going to have ongoing expenses that the government may or may not share, but certainly should be sharing, and those take the cost of the war up into the trillions of dollars, and that's all invisible to us right now because nobody's accounting for that. They're not accounting for the ongoing medical care and psychological care that's going to be needed by so many of the people that are being sent to Iraq.
The IRS certainly has a reputation as a fearsome organization to confront, and some of that comes from what feels like arcane rules and regulations, as well as a Kafkaesque logic that threatens any mere mortal who tangles with the system and threatens them with severe penalties.
If I could, I'd like to just say another word about fear, because I think that in this country, we have a tendency to really sort of let our fear get the best of us. And I know that in a situation where people are invading your home, they're bombing your neighborhood, you know, that is a kind of fear that most of us in this country aren't facing. We're facing the fear of a letter, perhaps, you know, an angry knock on our door in terms of, you know, war tax resistance. It's a fear that is not life-threatening, and yet we take it in sometimes and respond as if it is life-threatening. And in fact, you know, what's life-threatening is what's being done with our money. In so many ways, the conditions that many of our neighborhoods find themselves in is the direct result of money being taken out of our economies and sent off to war. So that, in fact, you know, people really are facing a fearful situation because of the very nature of the tax system that is robbing our communities. Yet when we stand up to try to do something about it, we're told that this is so very scary, when in fact, you know, you come right down to it, the risks are not that big. It's the fear of losing control. And that's one of the great things about war tax resistance is the IRS spends a lot of energy scaring people with threats of prison and, you know, all the terrible things they can do to you. They'll take your house. They'll throw you in jail. But in fact, what they really want is to get your money. And that's almost always the limit of what they'll do. They very, very rarely put people in jail. They very rarely take homes. So, you know, really what it comes down to is at what point do you continue to resist versus say, okay, let's sit down and talk and do that offer of compromise. You really do maintain a lot more control than they're going to tell you you have. And so, you know, it's putting your fear, not that you won't feel fear, because when they knocked on my door, you know, and I had two small children and they're saying, we're going to send you to federal prison, that was scary to me. But I put it within the perspective of, you know what, they're probably bluffing. And even if they aren't bluffing, they want me to pay. And I can, you know, if it comes right down to it and I need to decide to back down and pay, I can do that. So, you know, it's putting that fear in perspective and then making the choices, you know, if you are able to stand up to them.
Well, I have to say, when I was a single parent, the scary part for me was that an action that I did could impact my kids. Mm-hmm. You know, perhaps I would, I mean, I didn't have a lot of money, so any little bit counted, and having them come in and garnish my wages or something would mean that my kids were even more vulnerable and, you know, maybe all three of us would be out on the street.
Right. And this is why it's so great that there are, you know, there are legal methods, there are symbolic methods where someone who's in a situation that they can't take an economic risk could resist $10 a year. The government has to go through all the same procedures to try to collect that $10, but when it comes right down to it and they take it out of your bank account, they're going to take, you know, what, $12. You know, it's not going to cost you very much to have done that resistance. Mm-hmm. So at different times of life, when you don't have the, you know, the wherewithal to take a bigger risk, you can take a very small risk and you're still standing up.
That is Susan Quinlan, who has consistently resisted paying money to war and militarism for 25 years. I'm Susan Gallimore, and you're listening to Raising Sand Radio. Learn more about our shows by visiting our website, raisingsandradio.org, where you can also download any of our shows for free. And if you're feeling particularly generous today, you can also make a donation to our work. You'll see the donate button on our website, and we would be very grateful for anything you can spare. We turn now to Elizabeth Borden, who talks to us by phone about her second experience of war tax resistance.
Well, yes, I was involved with the telephone tax resistance during the Vietnam War so long ago. And I think it was because I was the treasurer for the Northern California phone tax that the IRS finally came after me. Because, you know, the tax was something like 76 cents a month. And so the dollar amount that I owed them was not very much, but they did, after 3 or 4 years, come and say they were going to put a lien on my house. And I was a single parent raising 4 children in that house. And so, of course, I paid what I owed them, and I paid the penalties, and I paid the interest and everything. And I basically just bailed. But I had always known that that might happen. I was willing to go a certain distance as a ideological, faith-based protester, but I wasn't prepared to go further. And I'm hoping that this time around, too, you know, there's still always the option of paying up and or paying under protest and sort of getting stabilized and then doing the thing again.
Elizabeth finds that choosing when and how to resist gives her needed flexibility.
Well, I did it during the Vietnam era, and then after that, like so many people, I was in a job where all my money was withheld from my paycheck. I didn't do the maneuver that many folks do, where you say that you declare, I think the maximum is 9 allowances, and that means the IRS doesn't withhold so much money, and then you may end up owing some money at the end of the year, and you can refuse to pay it. I didn't do that because I have a religious thing about always telling the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, and so I wasn't prepared to say that I had 9 allowances when I didn't. But I am going to do it again now, and I do have a bank account, and I do own property, and I am not going to be able to use legal means to resist. So therefore, the way I think of it is I am going to commit civil disobedience, which means that although I am a law-abiding citizen generally, in this case, I believe that my country is doing the wrong thing and that my allegiance to my religious principles is higher, and I cannot pay for this war.
Elizabeth Borden has certainly considered what she's willing to do this time around and how she makes those decisions.
So then I look at the numbers, and Susan was talking a little bit about how much of our budget and how much of our tax dollars goes to the war. I want to help pay for the cost of the care of veterans. I'm quite concerned about the inadequate support that the Veterans Administration is providing. So I will pay for the veterans, but I don't want to pay for the other costs of war, so I'm going to withhold 41% of my tax bill and send the rest with a cover letter saying, sorry, folks, I basically am a good citizen, but one of the roles of the citizen of a democracy is to tell your government when you think that they are making a mistake. And I've told my government by letters and petitions and by marching in the streets, but you know what they say, you can march all you like as long as you pay your taxes. We don't care how much you march in the street. And so that's not adequate for me anymore. I need to not pay. And I don't have that job where the money was withheld anymore. I quit that job, and this last year I worked as a consultant on a contract, and no money was withheld. And so now I have the choice about whether to pay up or not. And I did that on purpose so that I would be able to choose not to pay the 41% that I calculate is being used for past and present wars.
So is tax resistance something for other women to consider?
Well, you know, I think it's a challenge because many married women, when they hear that I'm thinking of withholding taxes, say, I file jointly with my husband and he would never think of it. And so those women do have a bigger challenge. I mean, you know, getting around your husband is sometimes might take them more effort than dealing with the IRS.
That was Elizabeth Borden, who recognizes that some women may find it easier to deal with the IRS than with their spouses, who would never consider not paying taxes. Susan Quinlan, too, finds that couples who may agree with protesting war may have quite different ideas about how to go about that protest.
I think that there are a lot of lifestyle negotiations that war tax resistors go through, and resolving conflicts with partners can be one of them. It's very helpful to have the support of a life partner if you're going to take this stand. And so, you know, that may be something that people work into, or it may change over time as well. For example, some people will start resisting before they have kids and then find that once they have kids, something becomes more complicated and they don't have the energy for it, and then they can simply change their method and choose to resist in a different way.
Thank you to Susan Quinlan and Elizabeth Borden for sharing their stories about war tax resistance with us today. If you want to know more, contact the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee and or the Northern California War Tax Resistance Group. And that is our show for today, and thanks for listening. Visit our website, raisingsandradio.org, to learn more about our work, or you can contact me directly at susan@raisingsandradio.org. We go out with Pink Floyd and Money.
Money, so they say.